Hello and welcome. It's been a week of political aftershocks here in France after the earthquake that was President Macron's sudden call for snap election, his gambit in testing the far-right's EU election triumph, and his banking on it being just a sign of voter frustration is an all-the-chips-on-the-table moment, and early polls suggest a national rally are on course for victory.
We are at a time when our country must rise to a number of challenges and cannot be blocked by extremes.
It's been a week that's seen the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen celebrate election success for her centre-right party and begin tactical manoeuvres to get a second go at the EU's most powerful post. As the lead candidate in the centre-right group, which picked up most seats on Sunday, VDL, as she is known, is in the driving seat. But it's a secretive process. We'll explain the negotiations and bargaining at play.
Together with others, we will build a bastion against the extremes from the left and from the right. We will stop them.
And it's been a week that's seen clashes between protesters and police outside the Argentinian Senate. Inside, the right-wing libertarian leader Javier Milei managed to get his first set of radical laws through Parliament after 6 months of pushback. The president that called himself El Loco claims the chaos on the streets is short-term pain for long-term gain. We'll analyse what he's achieved since coming to office.
Estamos ante una bifurcación.
We are at a crossroads. Either we continue on the path of decline, or we dare to take the path of freedom. This battle has even been fought on the streets.
Welcome to the world this week. Joining me on the international press corps this week in the studio, we have Elisabeth Pinault, the Elysee correspondent for Reuters news agency. Hello, Elisabeth.
Good evening.
We also have Ana Navarro-Pedro, the Paris-based correspondent for Portuguese Press. Hello to you. And let's go to Brussels too. We have Mark Burley, correspondent for Agence France-Presse, AFP. Thank you, Mark. It is good to see you.
And great. Nice to be back.
Great to have you with us tonight. Let's go straight in tonight, because it has been a week that has seen, on Sunday, Emmanuel Macron shock all but his own team of insiders when he delivered a televised address to the nation, announcing the dissolution of Parliament and the calling of snap legislative elections. A House of Cards moment, an immediate and dramatic response to the far-right national rally's triumph in EU elections, and a high-stakes gambit, the biggest since he came to office. It's an act of trust, he said, trust in the capacity of the French people to make the right decision.
Everyone was saying the far right is coming in 2027. It will give power to Marine Le Pen. It's already written. Well, no, I don't want to give the far right power in 2027, so I have to take full responsibility for setting in motion a process of clarification, primarily because the French people asked us to do so on Sunday.
The on-the-night victorious leader of National Rally, 28-year-old Jordan Bardella, claimed it was day one of the post-Macron era.
Emmanuel Macron is a weakened president tonight. The defeat of the leading power marks the end of a cycle and the first day of post-Macron times that we will build.
Early polls suggest a far-right win, not by majority, though. Cue a week of political dramas between other parties. A planned alliance for the left, the Socialists, Greens, far-right, far-left France unbowed too, getting the old band back together. The NUPES coalition, it was called back in the day, the New Ecological and Socialist People's Union, until it disbanded over disagreements. And summing up their collective fear of the far right, François Ruffin said, "We either unite together or lose separately." By Wednesday, the front door of the centre-right Republicans Party HQ was a star of the show. Cameras fixed onto the building through the day. It was reported its leader, Eric Ciotti, had locked himself in to prevent a meeting of MPs kicking him out for these comments.
An alliance with the National Rally, with its candidates. An alliance of the right wing with all those who identify with right wing values. I think the country has never been so right wing. It is waiting for the right. It is waiting for action from the right.
By Thursday, curtains for Ciotti. Or so we thought. He's been voted out by party members, but carried on anyway, dismissing the efforts as, quote, quibbles to oust him between mediocre people. Well, next, it talks of a union of the far right and even further right, National Rally and Reconquest, which thinks the rally is too soft on immigration. The party's vice president, Marion Maréchal, suggesting an alliance with her aunt, Marine Le Pen's party. A day later, she was out on her ear, excluded from Reconquest by its leader, Eric Zemmour. So where to begin with our analysis? Elisabeth Pinault, take your pick.
What a week. I mean, last week I was in Normandy with Macron and everybody, and really we did not expect what the bomb that exploded on Sunday night. And I went to the National Assembly on Monday morning, and it was a state of shock, really. I mean, most of the MPs were away. The remaining ones were just, you know, between anger and concern, mostly concerned, and it's still like that. You know, people are trying to recover from this bomb of Sunday night. And then, day by day, the parties, everybody tried to organize with the Républicain drama, the Marion Maréchal drama, where every day there was something new. And today, well, we got this agreement in the left. So now something new is starting now. You see the three camps already, you know, the presidential camp with Macron and his press conference on Thursday, where he explained that he wanted things to be clarified. We've got the National Rally. They are ready. They are preparing a government. They will present their economy program at the beginning of next week. And then the left, it's quite a surprise that they were so divided this last month that they are reunited considering the gravity of the situation. So the polls that are going to be out next week will be interesting to see, because for the moment you said that, the National Rally is supposed to get the majority, but things could get close or change next week. We'll see. Yes. That would mean also that in the end, it could be totally an ungovernable country, because if we've got three blocks with, you know, like 150 MPs, it would be very difficult to pass the law and to govern the country. It's really a matter of concern.
Anna, we're in the middle of, still, does it feel like to you that we're in the middle of a political storm?
Oh, we're just at the beginning of a huge political storm looming over France. What this president did is unbelievable. It's inconsequential. You don't gamble a country, you don't gamble a people, you don't gamble a nation on a poker table. And that's what we all are saying outside of France, in European Union. That's what we are seeing in his political game. The French have now 3 weeks to go to the polls again, when there are so many essential things to debate upon in this country or any other country in Western Union, in Western Hemisphere, things like, problems with the dollar, problems with unemployment, retail is having a huge storm in the United States. It's going to come over to Europe. That means unemployment. That means growth going down. You have intelligence, artificial intelligence coming into everyday life, into production, and it means again unemployment. It means what to do with people, what solutions to pick up. Those are things that are crucial, and we have only people only trying to rush to make agreements for in 2 weeks, because first week is, you know, just to present candidates and do administrative paperwork, and in 2 weeks to put a discussion up to the people of this country when they are about to leave on holiday and they have their holidays. This is absolutely amazing. This is inconsequential. This is this is not responsible. And this is how are we seeing Macron everywhere in Europe and in the rest of Europe? And I'll stop here, but in the rest of Europe, France is a crucial country in Brussels, in Strasbourg. No one is taking any notice now. None of the French election new MPs, member of European Parliament, are paying attention to the constitution of commissions, president of commissions, vice president of commissions, and so forth, that is going on right now in Strasbourg and Brussels. It's amazing. I mean, if Macron was hoping to have an European destiny, I mean, he can make a cross on it.
Mark Burley, Anna Navarro saying this is deeply irresponsible of Emmanuel Macron. I want to know two things from you. First of all, your reaction on the night, and 5 days on, that sense of whether you think he had any alternative. Some in his party say, well, you know, he was going to be a lame duck president.
Well, myself, I was working like a lot of journalists in Brussels for 4 days on the EU elections, and we kind of thought that when Sunday rolled around, that was going to be the biggest story in Europe, the elections and how the far right did and all the rest of it. And then President Macron did his political earthquake, and immediately, you know, I could feel it. 1,000 journalists around, everybody could feel it. The attention had shifted to Paris. It was, it was a bit of a shock through everybody, obviously for his government as well, from the looks on their faces that we've seen. So, that has kind of overshadowed a lot of what the diplomats are talking here, even as we're, you know, getting ready for the new European Parliament and who's going to get the top jobs around the EU. A lot of the diplomats are still talking about what Macron did. Now, you know, you could say it's clear. I think everybody agrees that it's a huge gamble, a huge risk that he's taking. I think he said at the G7 today that other leaders came around him and said he made a courageous decision. And I think we can all agree that when someone says in politics you were courageous, that is kind of like a double-edged comment that you have to take on the chin. A lot of people are saying that, you know, what could have been interpreted as a general protest vote, the EU election is not a national election by any means. There's very big differences. Taking a protest vote against himself and turning it into a snap national election could be a mistake, as I'm hearing from the studio there. I'm also seeing some other political observers saying maybe there was a strategy behind it. Maybe it's either the French voters really have to make up a mind. There's a difference between backing the far right when they're just sniping from opposition corners, which is a very easy position to be in against the government, and to crystallize in their brains the fact that this could be the party that is ruling the government in some way coming up. That can crystallize. The other possible strategic goal of this was that perhaps having the far right come into government could, if they fail spectacularly, could block the path to Marine Le Pen, the real face of the national rally, becoming president, taking over from President Macron, who, of course, is in his second and constitutionally last term. 2027, he has to step down. Someone has to step in. And, Marine Le Pen, who's tried several times for the presidency, sees this as her best chance. Maybe Macron has just sort of stepped in for what in France is really the bigger game. Yes, it's very important who rules the government. There's a lot of things at stake, but it's an executive presidency in France. That is a key position. As we've already seen with Macron, he's been able to pass laws that he wanted to pass just by the power of being president without even having, legislative approval. So that maybe that's his key game. Maybe it's a mistake. Let's see.
Very interesting, Elizabeth. Mark talking about this bigger chess
strategy,
gambit.
Yes.
However, do you think he, given that speech that we had where he said, come and combine, let's unite, an alliance of all parties of Republican values. Do you think he kind of saw it coming that the left would unite as they have?
No, I don't think so. I think he just didn't expect, well, he made a, well, we heard poker, we heard that it was more a foolish decision than a courageous decision, really. And he was maybe expecting, yes, everybody to divide and maybe come together to him. But maybe also the other idea, and you said it in Brussels, that he wants a national rally to come to power and fail to save the country in 27. But really, it's so Machiavellic, really, that it's hard to believe. In a way, we were expecting something in the autumn after the Olympic Games. That's an important thing. I mean, we haven't spoken about that. But really, the world will have the eyes on France in like a month and yeah. a half. Paris is getting ready. So it seems all the most incredible to have done that before the Olympic Games. But well, he did it because we were expecting something in the autumn, really, because he was stuck, really. Macron, he is very unpopular. It was very hard for him to pass the laws at the parliament. So we were expecting something, maybe a new government, maybe something. Well, it happened earlier, but we see the result. But really, well, he made the bomb explode, but the result is not sure at all, really. It could be a national rally. It could be the left. It could be a total stuck. The country can be stuck for the next month, and there are, of course, economical concerns already. The stock market went down on Monday, and all the economical world is very worried, and it can go very, very quick.
Is the counter to that? I mean, you mentioned the Olympics. We heard Anne Hidalgo, the Paris socialist mayor, saying, what on earth is he thinking? We had people within his own party. You talked about a second ago the surprise feeling we had Fabienne Keller, sitting where you are, of the Renew Party. When he was making the announcement, we asked for her response. She said, I haven't got time to think, to process.
State of shock, really.
This is in his own party. And yet, if this is done and dusted in the next 2 weeks or so, and people have that stand-back moment to process the Olympics... You talk about Machiavellian side of this, another sense that you get on with the life of politics, it kickstarts again in the autumn? Or do you simply think it was the wrong time, the wrong place?
It was the wrong time, it was the wrong moment. Yes, we were expecting something like that for the autumn, which means maybe a new government, a technical government until September, October, and then with time, new elections, a snap election will be called, but with time for parties to organize, for programs to be set up, to be thought, because there is a huge... The program by the left, it's incredible how they made it in 2 or 3 days while they were so divided, like until 4 days ago. Still, when you look at it, there are lots of good intentions, but if you're going to put that program up, if, for instance, they win and one of them has to be go on government, if they are going to put to practice that program, financial markets are going to react in a very, very dire way. And they are already reacting like that. So France has... their last bonds issues, borrowing money, you know, for the expenses of the country, it's already with a very high interest rate, huge interest rate. It is going to aggravate the charge of the debt. So I see this situation getting terribly confusing. And on top of it, as Elizabeth said before, we might not have a clear majority. We can have one that has a majority that might be then called to form government, but we might have two blocks, left and extreme left wing, extreme right wing, and maybe a little bit of liberals and Republicans in the middle, and we'll have two extremist political forces face to face in France. And the French are not known for being patient.
And there are going to be demonstrations tomorrow, Saturday, all over France against far right. So it could be violent, we'll see. It could be also a democratic, race, but we'll see. And a financial crisis is around the corner. That's what Bruno Le Maire says. He thinks that the heavy spending plans of the far right and the far left is just unbearable for France.
Well, they are not much worse than what they have been doing for 7 years.
Yeah, but I think this won't be enough to stop people from voting for something else, somebody else than the government.
Mark, you talked about the people saying to him, you've been courageous, and Elizabeth talked about Machiavellian. And actually, it's interesting because the old Prime Minister of Italy, Matteo Renzi, a socialist, talked this week about saying he thinks it was courageous. He thinks it's also brilliantly Machiavellian. He said, I'm from Florence. This is incredible politics we're seeing right now.
Yeah.
And if we get into the weeds of this a bit and look at, we just talked about some of how the left have united. Let's also talk about the centre-right, the Republicans, and what on earth is going on behind the door at the HQ, Eric Ciotti, the leader, making these comments. Talk us through that and the backlash he's faced.
Well, I've got to say, for the whole Ciotti, I've been watching. I'm a French citizen as well, and I've got a vote, and all the French politics is certainly interesting me greatly as a French citizen, and the drama over the last few days of what's been happening with you know, the Les Républicains and Reconquête. I mean, that has kept me totally glued to the screens. But I got to say that sitting in Brussels and being a reporter up here and having a view across Europe and even abroad, sort of the consequences of Macron's decision interest me as well. And, you know, I've been very interested in the effect on Germany, where, you know, Chancellor Olaf Scholz came out very badly out of the EU elections. Unlike Macron, though, he's not calling for snap elections, but the pressure is building on him because the far right came ahead of his party, came out in second place in Germany. And you just talked about Italy, which is now ruled by a far-right prime minister, Giorgia Meloni, who's hosting the G7 right now. And while she's not entirely of the same stripe as Le Pen and has shown a very pragmatic side since coming to power, and we're not quite sure whether she will do some sort of, or have her party in the European Parliament do some sort of alliance with Le Pen's party or not. She's being very coy about all of that. The fact is that if we ended up with a far-right government in France, you have to kind of think, what is the spillover effect towards Germany, which is struggling against a surging far-right in the east of the country, with a far-right-run Italy? And, you know, we've got to talk about the other elephant in the room, which is also perhaps a Donald Trump presidency from next year. How does all this far-rightedness align in European and perhaps global terms?
Well, it brings us on nicely, Mark, to, well, what was going on over the weekend. Well, Emmanuel Macron, after a weekend of culinary diplomacy, hosting President Biden at the Elysee Palace, as Elizabeth mentioned, he had barely time to digest the four-course state meal of the night before, light salad of fennel, green peas, chicken, assorted petals, and a finale of chocolate, strawberries, raspberries, shaped like a rose, enlivened by a coulis of carnal thorns. Well, he started a process at the same time the projections coming in across Europe, and it became clear across the EU, centrist parties remain the dominant force, the centre-right European People's Party picking up most seats.
Together with others, we will build a bastion against the extremes from the left and from the right. We will stop them, this is for sure.
Ursula von der Leyen in a strong position to retain the most powerful job in the EU. We're going to get to that in a moment. But staying with the results and the fallout this week, the centrist old Liberal parties lost ground. So too did the Greens, the hard-right nationalists of the European Conservatives and Reformists, and the far-right Identity and Democracy parties gained in many countries. But not all, such as Spain, not so much so in Germany and Portugal too. Anna, you've been looking at the Portuguese situation this week.
The good news, if you are not from the far right, is that the far right in Portugal has lost like half of their votes in this election. Like 2 months ago or 3 months ago, there were snap elections and they had like 18%. Now they are 9% in this election. So this is maybe someone coming, the people coming to their senses about this party.
Was there something different in the dynamic over Chega, the party that says enough? Was there something different from the other parties that you did were not seeing elsewhere?
Well, we have the Prime Minister in Portugal that only has a very, very, very short lead on the Socialist Party, like two seats in Parliament. Right from the beginning, he was saying, I want to any alliance with the far right. And some members of his party, which is centre-right, if you want, or I would say an old-tradition conservative party, were saying, no, we should make a coalition with far-right. So the jury is still out in Portugal for that part, because usually European elections have no impact whatsoever in our national politics, but this time, because of this very short lead on parliamentary elections. And now that the socialists got a very short lead on European elections, we see that we have two blocs that are centre-right, centre-left, more or less, and the kingmaker is the far-right, even if they have lost some power. They've lost some arrogance as well with this. So, but the jury is still out. Can we have a coalition with the far-right in Portugal? The year we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of
Coronation Revolution.
Of, yes, and the fall of the dictatorship.
A quick word also about one of those faces being touted for one of Europe's top jobs, former Prime Minister António Costa, possible European Council president.
Yes. He seems to be very well placed to succeed Charles Michel, although there is this problem in Portugal. His government came down because there were the justice were investigating some members of his cabinet on corruption cases. And then there was this big mess where the judges said, yes, we have a recording where some of these people who are being accused are talking about Costa as one of them. Okay, so he said, no, I'm not at all in any of that. He resigned, his government came down, we had snap elections. And then 2 days later, just the judges came out and said, we messed up. It was a recording, it was another Costa. It was not him.
There are many Costas in Portugal.
So, and it was someone from his government. So now he has been heard, but he's not indicted or anything like that. I believe that in Europe, we know that everybody, I mean, in Portugal, we have the feeling that he was not in this mess, but we also have the feeling that he should have been more careful with the people he surrounded himself with. Now, he is an excellent negotiator. He's has an excellent knowledge of European makings and
Workings. Yeah.
And he has a very good general political culture. So he might be a good choice. I don't know if the Nordic European countries won't be their usual, very moral countries.
Well, they seem to be.
They weren't with Ursula von der Leyen, who was under investigation and still is because it was stopped. The investigation was stopped about corruption in her former job as defense minister in Germany.
Although they
but
seem to
maybe
be forming
Portugal
around
will be more put on the spot than Germany. Perhaps. We don't know.
Well, the Nordics seem to be forming around Mette Frederiksen, the Danish prime minister right now. We shall see. Mark, you talked about it a moment ago, the difficulties and the good results elsewhere. There are some far-right parties doing extremely well. Giorgia Meloni's Brothers of Italy, like you said, better than expected, around 29%. The Polish Law and Justice Party, you know, on the hard right, doing well. There are some results that didn't go the way the far-right. The Dutch PVV of Geert Wilders didn't do as like they did in the elections domestically 6 months ago. La Liga in Italy fared worse. It's a checkered picture, isn't it?
Yeah, it is indeed very, very checkered. I mean, it's correct to say at a European level the centre held. It's also correct to say that the far right still did pretty well. You can't ignore how well they did. Yeah, Geert Wilders came second, but only just and behind the party of Frans Timmermans, a former EU commissioner. You know, the PIS in Poland lost ground to Donald Tusk, former European Council president. It lost ground in Hungary, but, you know, it scored like 45% or something, the ruling Fidesz party. So it still did very well in Hungary, even if it lost ground. So, yeah, there's no clear-cut narrative, if you like, about that. In terms of the jobs, I just want to say something about António Costa. I mean, obviously, he has his merits of, I mean, he's well-liked by Macron. Apparently, they have wonderful intellectual discussions together and And Costa speaks French, and that's
I don't know if it's a blessing or curse now, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry?
I said I don't know if it's a blessing or curse now, being sitting close to Macron right now. I think those within his party are worried about what he says for the sake of the elections. No, carry on. That's really interesting.
Well, there's politics and who your friends are. There's also, I got to tell you, in Brussels, EU summits that can go for days and nights, and sometimes it's nice to be sitting next to someone you can share a bit of Sartre or something with. But in terms of the there's a lot of horse trading for the top jobs. So basically, the job that is probably most prized politically as head of the Commission. Mm. That's the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, currently, and probably next, has executive power, steps out, is basically, because of Ursula von der Leyen, has become the face of the European Union. She's from the conservative European People's Party. Now, they came basically in first place, not with the majority, but in first place in the EU elections. She looks like probably, most likely, will clinch a second term. When EU leaders get together on next Monday for a dinner to sort of like flesh out who they think, and then they'll be having a summit in late June to basically formalize it, she looks like she'll get in. Because she's EPP, which is the Conservatives, the next post that everybody looks at is the European Council President. It can't go to EPP, of course, because they've got the Commission. It goes to the next biggest grouping, which is Socialists and Democrats, which is Costa's party. Also, geographically, he comes from the south of Europe, not the north, which is another factor you have to look at. So with von der Leyen as Commission President, someone from the south, someone from the socialist left wing, Costa. Looks like that's a pretty good pairing. And the other post that we've all got our eyes on right now is who replaces Josep Borrell as high rep, as a high representative vice president of the Commission. It's basically the foreign minister of Europe. Very important post, especially with everything that's happening in the world right now. So that, given that Renew, to which Macron's party belongs in the European Parliament, came in third place, that should go to a Renew position. And because we've got North and South in Europe covered, it has to be, should be, the weighting is, it should probably go to the East. So we're kind of thinking maybe Kaja Kallas from Estonia for that. She's well placed. Maybe not as much of a shoo-in as we expect Madame von der Leyen and Costa at the Council.
Very good analysis and thought there. And I was standing in that building just behind you back in 2019 where we were all waiting with a horse trading going on. And it became known, Ursula von der Leyen, and people were saying, or correspondents like yourself saying, not you, but others say, how do you pronounce it? It was a voice that wasn't a familiar face or voice at all. Elizabeth, interesting timing that Mark referred to as well, because we're going to have this key meeting next week. This is before the French elections, and previously President Macron had a number of requests of Ursula von der Leyen before he let her take the job. I just wonder, there are questions about whether he lets this happen without too much fuss, because he's busy right now.
Oh, yes, we've been much more busy with the political storm in France, so we didn't look at what's going on in Brussels this week, not very close. What I know is, we spoke to Macron's entourage, and they're backing Costa for president of the European Council, for sure. And we were told also that he's backing Ursula von der Leyen. We were not sure before in the corridors, we heard that maybe he preferred Mario Draghi, but Macron's entourage, he had lunch with Ursula von der Leyen last Friday or Thursday at the Elysee, so they could discuss the dissolution and everything. And the Macron's entourage told us that Macron doesn't want to add European instability to French instability, but what they say. So they think is Ursula von der Leyen is stability, is nothing too messy. That's what they told us, at least.
Which takes us nicely to Puglia, South Italy. South-South is in the heel of the boot on the map, South. It's where we lay our scene for Thursday, when G7 leaders met at the family-run Borgo Ignazia Hotel Resort for A-list guests, $2,500 a night, according to TripAdvisor. Politico website flashed up one of the most noticeable headlines of the week. This, six lame ducks and Giorgia Meloni, it read, after the stinging EU election results for German and French leaders arriving there. The UK's Rishi Sunak accused of D-Day dodging and President Biden facing his own domestic difficulties. This week's gathering of G7 leaders in Italy, it says, looks more like the Last Supper than a display of Western power, the article jibes. So, on the agenda, Gaza conflict, China, Ukraine, an agreement was reached on the use of interest on Russia's frozen assets being given to Ukraine. Joe Biden said it was another reminder, Russia, to tell them we're not backing down. Moscow since threatened retaliation with extremely painful measures, says President Putin. Also a 10-year bilateral security deal between the US and Ukraine.
Our goal is to strengthen Ukraine's credible defense and deterrence capabilities for the long term. A lasting peace for Ukraine must be underwritten by Ukraine's own ability to defend itself now and to deter future aggression anytime in the future. The United States is going to help ensure that Ukraine can do both, not by sending American troops to fight in Ukraine, but by providing weapons and ammunition, expanding intelligence sharing, continuing to train brave Ukrainian troops at bases in Europe and the United States, enhancing interoperability between our militaries in line with NATO standards.
This is an agreement on security and thus on the protection of human life. This is an agreement on cooperation and thus on how our nations will become stronger. This is an agreement on steps to guarantee sustainable peace, and therefore it benefits everyone in the world because the Russian war against Ukraine is a real, real global threat.
Okay, first of all, Anna, I'll start with you. Six lame ducks in Georgia Maloney. Is that unfair or nutshell accurate?
Absolutely accurate. You just mentioned the situation. Some of the heads of state are in that meeting. Let's remember Trudeau lagging behind the country, can't stand him anymore. On top of it, G7 was created with the seven most powerful nations in the world, the most rich ones. It's no longer true. It's absolutely. Italy and Canada are no longer on the top seven most rich countries. On top of it, if you use one notion of one way of measuring the riches of a country, which is the PPP, purchasing power parity, then even France is not in it anymore. And I think the UK is behind. So the world is changing, and this group is still behaving as if they are on top of the world, and they can whatever they can decide is based on a moral and power basis. It's no longer true. This is happening at the same time as, just the days before, Saudi Arabia decided not to reconduct a deal with the United States for buying always or selling always petrol in dollar currency. They can do it now in any currency they wish. Anybody can buy it now, petrol from Saudi Arabia, in the currency they wish. This is the beginning of the end of the petrodollar. So this is going to strive tensions between the dollar and the euro in some way, because if the dollar wants to survive, it will first go against the euro. That's one thing. As I said before, we have another thing. This also comes at the time when Turkey has shown its wish of joining the BRICS, you know, this union of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. There is a waiting list of 59 countries in the world who want to join them. And the stock exchange, thank you, in Russia, in Moscow, has stopped any dealings in dollars and in euros. This is all happening at the same time as the G7 is meeting, as if they don't see what's going around in the world. These are dangerous times, and our leaders are not really fit to deal with them.
It's a very interesting point. First, Mark, then Elizabeth, to the same question with Anna saying, actually, it's done, its time is over. It's not. There's no room for the G7 anymore. Mark?
Or a different one.
It's a Western club now. It's more than anything. It's not the world club. It's not the richest. A Western mind, a Western influence, Western decisions towards Ukraine. It's obvious. They agree on that. But China, India, Russia, Africa wouldn't say the same. So, yeah, you were definitely right. The world is changing. So
it's kind of an away day.
Yes.
Mark?
Well, if you're going to look at it as a rich club and sort of compare who's got the biggest wallets and stuff, that's not really the point of the G7. To me, I think that in an unstable world where the UN Security Council could no longer function because, you know, one of its permanent members is basically conducting war in Ukraine, and another one, China, is offering at least signs of political support, there need to be other forums for the West to come together and put actions, or at least, you know, like the deal that Biden signed with Zelensky, it's sort of trying to lock in U.S. Commitment to Ukraine. There has to be other forums than the U.N. The U.N. is, you want to talk about lame duck? There is an argument that the U.N. Security Council is a lame duck right now. I'm not going to say it, but I've heard the argument. So the G7 is an important block where you can coordinate at the highest level, because a lot of the tricky things we're going to look at need basically political decision makers. That's foreign minister on up. That's foreign minister, prime minister, head of state, whatever. They have to get together. The G7 plays an important role in that. I think the EU's profile has risen a lot since the war in Ukraine. You know, that there are much wiser foreign policy analysts than myself who get very nervous about what China might do towards Taiwan and what that will mean for the global security order and how decisions are made. So, you know, I wouldn't look at it as a rich club and look at, you know, PPP, the purchasing power. I don't think that's the point. I think it's the point that it gets together some very influential countries that do ally on some fairly significant issues, and as we're seeing increasingly on global security matters, because there's a vacuum there.
Mark, I just wonder, if you look at the, you know, you talk quite clearly about the many problems, and not just for G7, but the UN. Within the moment today of the meeting, there was kind of a viral moment. There's always something that happens that people pick up on social media. I want your thoughts, all of you, on this moment. This was President Biden and the rest of the leaders watching the parachute display today. He appears to disappear, and the internet seemed to blow up saying that he's lost it, he's too old, and Giorgia Meloni seems to get to walk him back. Now, his team have said he wasn't. He was just talking to other parachuters. Elizabeth, I don't know if you saw this, perhaps unfair.
I did not. I'm sorry.
Anna, you see this?
I did not, neither, but I mean, social media will just focus on something that is really not important. We know that he doesn't have all his intellectual means. So, I mean, we all have in our families at one point someone who's very old and he's just wandering off. So,
he's not always the
problem
president.
He's the president of the United States. Yeah. He's the head of the American military, and that is the problem. I just wanted to add something about what Mark said. It's really a different point of view of mine, and it's very interesting to have this global view. But I would also want to add that this G7 club of influential countries, as he said, they don't have also the military means, not anymore from what is being said, by their own military to weigh a lot in the world. And that is very upsetting.
Thank you, all of you, for today. Elizabeth Pinot, Anna Navarro Pedro, Mark, to you as well, Mark Burley in Brussels. Thank you all. We'll be back in 7 days' time for the world next week. Take care.